Questions are coming in, so let me start with them. The first one is should be very simple for you. Where can we buy the drum developed by the Swiss couple?
Well, that's called a hung, Hung, which I think it's a deliberate play on the like hung of Om Mani Padme Hung, of Hung of Tibetan Buddhism. And so it's available by a Swiss company. They're actually not cheap, but in more recent years, there are people making copies of them that are very, very similar. Sometimes they're called a space drum as well. So, but if you just look up hung, Hung, and hit YouTube, you'll hear examples of people playing it. And then you can follow your nose. And it is possible to buy them online. And I don't think there's any problem buying them online. The quality control is quite good. It's not like you're buying a Stradivarius. And certainly for myself, it's been a really fun, beautiful instrument. My son, who's 15, who's a tabla player, when he plays the hung and plays tabla rhythms, it's like the world is very, very exciting. So I can just say it does truly beautiful things. And this idea of combining melody and rhythm is, of course, very captivating. Such a lovely question. Let's go to the next one.
The next one is, if I want to be creatively successful, I need to compare to judge how good I am. This leads to critical judgment, which can kill creativity and stop development. How can something be good? Sorry, can something be good even if it's not?
This is almost at the heart of, we call this the great quandary, because obviously we have to learn to examine. Now I teach in a university where, we spend 3 to 4 years teaching people how to analyze music. You know what I mean? So people come up with, it really is a superpower. A graduate of the ANU School of Music, just like at the Royal College, they can hear anything and they can tell you the chords and the melody and they can deconstruct it completely. But they actually can't tell you whether it's good on a completely objective sense, because we are all subjective. Now, I just think this is a really profound thing because, if we just think about movements such as punk, I'm sort of a, I'm a bit of a, reserved classical musician by my trade, but I'm sort of in awe of what punk has done, because punk has said that you can turn up on a guitar that's not even in tune, having never had a guitar lesson, and you can move people as much as someone who studied music for 20 years. That's sort of incredible, isn't it? So I think the way around it is to say, for some part of our creative lives, we cannot do that thing that we do so well, which is to judge and compare. We have to learn to turn it off. And it is literally, I have a little mantra I said, which is, I'm putting a full stop on this. Actually, I use it quite a lot in a lot of my life. When I can see that things aren't going well for me, I just want to put a full stop and end that sentence, whether it's the sentence of gibberish, or the sentence of control, or the sentence of, ego, whatever it is. And I think over time we can get better at that process. And then when we start to build up a body of significant creativity over time, we can start to see that progression. I also think that all of us have, for want of a better term, a golden age of creativity at some point. When we start a practice, it's like you hear this story, particularly with singers, that they can. In 1 year of learning, they can get so far, maybe 70% of their what they'll ultimately be, and the other 30% might take 5 to 10 years of practicing every day. This is the nature of life. It's snakes and ladders. We get incredible insights, and then there's years and years of hard graft. Now, there is no substitute for just making art to make art or be creative. Now, we've all heard the myth of the 10,000 hours, but the latest research is a bit more depressing than that. It's 40,000 hours. It actually takes 40,000 hours if you're naturally good at, say, art music, for want of a better term, to be one of the greats. That's if you have the disposition. But if you think about it, that's just the life spent completely obsessing by what makes us happy and by doing it. So it's bad news, but it's also good news. It means that we should just keep doing it. But I would say that there's no problem if not everything you write is good. Mozart, there's so many myths around. Some of Mozart's music's not that good, actually. I mean, most of it's just incredible, and I would actually, be happy to write any one of his pieces, to be honest. But for Mozart, not all of it's as good as everything else, And so that's probably, people say, that the greatest creative free spirit in classical composition ever. Even if you look at the great jazz musicians, some of their solos are incredible, and some of them are just forgettable. So we all can't be perfect all the time, but by keeping on going, something remarkable does happen. I'm a real fan of that. that creativity is muscular. Just as you can become like, someone with really big biceps, you can become someone with really big creative biceps over time.
Wow, I look forward to developing my muscles, that's for sure. The next question is, I suffer from writer's block, and when I meditate, my thinking mind takes over. Are the two connected?
Now, this is such a great question because all of us have writer's block at times, Certainly, I know many of our most famous composers here in Australia, and most of them have said to me at some point in their career they've suffered from writer's block. I've suffered from it a couple of times in my life, so I understand it as well. All as I can say is, if you're meditating and this thinking mind takes over, if you fight it, that will be your experience in meditation for quite some time. My feeling is that something is emerging and will pass. I do believe this very strongly, that sometimes when we give ourselves the space to meditate, things need to be processed through the conscious mind. So they come out of the subconscious or the superconscious, and they actually just have to come into the mind to be processed. So there's a couple of practices that can be quite good. One I love, it's a Buddhist practice called Adhidhamma, which was originally a Burmese Buddhist practice. Which is when we have these strong things coming through the mind, there can be a belief in a practice, but please do this with great care and never harm yourself. That if you're to sit in complete silence and not move at all, that sometimes we can allow the sensations of the mind to become sensations of the body. In other words, that part of what is coming in the mind can actually be released as a physical sensation in the body if we don't scratch the itch. This is actually, some people say, one of the first teachings the Buddha gave Ananta, which is a very interesting idea. And probably the most famous contemporary teacher was Goenkaji from the Vipassana series of meditation courses. I think this is something worth exploring. I've certainly spent a lot of time in my life trying it. And I do love the feeling that maybe for every thought, there was a potential physical sensation, even if it's not true. It's a captivating thought. So that's one thing to try. The next one is to use something to circumnavigate what the mind does. And this is where, in most religious traditions, there are a number of practices. I'll just hold up my little beads. Sometimes, some people go, oh, this is all superstition. But, if I was to be honest, I have to go to a lot of meetings that are quite dry, where there's just spreadsheets and, stuff like that. And sometimes I need to be really, really present, but sometimes I can just go, Om Mani Padme Hum or Om Shanti, Om Shanti, Om Shanti. And so to circumnavigate the brain world that just goes into repetitive thoughts and, essentially through that same looking glass of self-criticism or criticism of others, just to have something that protects the mind. Now, the definition of mantra historically is that which protects the mind from itself in some ways. So having something that is like your mantra, whether it's following the breath or whether it's even just saying a phrase, that can be very, very good. One teacher I know very well has a very simple method that I love, and that is breathing in love, breathing out peace. And just doing that when to enable the mind to become a little bit unlocked. So it's worth experimenting with those things. It's a very difficult thing to solve quickly, but I always have the feeling that sustained practice does, it melts away those giant ice blocks of blockage.
That was interesting. Thank you. So, what I really appreciate is that you're sharing meditation techniques from many, many different schools, and that sometimes one works, sometimes something else works, and just to stay open to all of that. The next question. Any advice for singers who are putting aside their creativity for the time being to focus on technique?
Oh, such a great question again. Now, can I tell you that my partner's an opera singer and my father was an opera singer. So I spent my life around singers who were worrying about their technique. And, we have, of course, a vocal department. Actually, our voice teacher, Cheryl Barker, is just an incredible, incredible singer. So this discussion happens all the time at my music school. And this is what the consensus is at the moment. To sing, you have to be both very, very dumb and very, very smart. Now, this is a terrible thing to say. Why should we be dumb? Because some things we don't need to know. Like, just as we don't need to follow the process of speaking once we've learned it, we should be able to trust some things to our physiology. But then now I also want to say that there's a relativistic thing in singing, because I'm presuming that's classical singing or jazz singing, so something in a Western tradition, because those two forms of training are specific and detailed. You know, it takes 10 years to really learn classical singing. So the first thing I'd say is that if you don't get it immediately and you see someone else who got it quickly, well, that's just how it is. The second thing is, because the relationship between the voice and the body is so profound and so deep and so affected by every thought that goes into the mind, you know, that's the difference between the voice and an instrument, that we really are transformed by the thoughts we have every day by our singing. And there's so many experiments you can do about your singing voice that have nothing to do with the technique you would learn in music school or by a good teacher. Things like changing diet and seeing what a change in diet does to you. Or another classic one is through the notion of eating before you sing or not eating before you sing, drinking certain things, visualizations. All of these things can be almost as powerful as Western technique. But if you are practicing Western technique, what I'd like to do is to see it as a spiritual offering, because, you know, I still, you know, I don't get as much time as I used to, but almost the most beautiful thing I can do now is play my scales. And so I want you to feel that what you're doing is you're making part of a sacred mandala every time you practice, and you're just making the inner parts of that mandala, that sort of sacred picture or sacred puzzle, come together. And so every bit of technique is a part of that pattern. And when you're just making a little bit of that pattern, it doesn't look that exciting. But when you've actually made the finished mandala, that you get something quite beautiful. So the reason why I say that is that that is creative, you know, because it's incredibly creative to be able to find ways to make more beauty come out of my instrument as a singer. That's an incredible act of creativity. And unfortunately for everything, we can feel that, oh, we don't get to do the fun stuff enough. So the way around that is to make everything fun. I see that quite in, you know, I mean, we have a, you know, maybe I'm just a very hard taskmaster, but one of the things we set up at the ANU School of Music, we call it the 6-hour club. So we want students to have a 6-hour relationship with themselves several days a week if they can. So they go into a practice room, and it's not that they just practice, but they actually have that time to examine themselves as artists in a sustained sense. And I find that is very deeply transformative. So sometimes just stop the technique, sing without the technique, record yourself, see what you really like. Because one of the things that can come up is that when we are being taught a technique that is so-called right to be an opera singer or a jazz singer or a contemporary singer or a music theatre singer or anything, we might actually be missing the point that the singer we want to be is none of those. And it's someone who processes the teachings of these teachers to make their own thing. That might be your life path. Without knowing you or your music, I really couldn't say, but you should be open to that as well.
Thank you. The next question. I would like to hear a little about successful collaboration. How do I retain my integrity and be open to others?
Can I just say, as a general thought, I just can't believe how beautiful these questions are. They're moving, they're personal, and there's no sense of guardedness. This is at the heart of being an artist, right? Because, of course, we could say, oh, I just, you know, I can be, you know, stuck on my island and make something of beauty and then just hand it over and someone else does that. But that's not really that much fun. Even when you talk to writers, they often say that the joy is when they find out what other people have thought when they read it, which is an act of collaboration, isn't it? But I think what you're talking about is, if I'm an artist and I collaborate with someone else, so I could be, you know, part of a band and that I could be writing the lyrics or the words, or I could be working with someone else. And this is not easy, you know. I think what we need to do is find people that do two things to us. One is, honestly, what they do should really excite us. We should feel, as soon as we hear what they do or read what they can do or see their visual art, whatever it is, that they have something that makes us more complete. You know, it sounds a very selfish thing, but why would we collaborate in this precious life unless we feel there was something to be learned, you know, from them, that they have something really deep and profound to teach us? And then we would hope, if they're going to be interested in us, that we have something to teach them, you know, at the same way. And so I think that the fundamental relationship is this relationship of sharing not the relationship of outcome. I believe that very strongly. I mean, I collaborate a lot. I was going to show you today, I'm doing a collaboration with a fellow called Professor Brad Tucker, who's one of our heads of astrophysicists at the ANU. He's a bit of one of those sort of media darlings because he talks very well about all of those things. And we send up once or twice a year a balloon into space from the ANU. And the last one he did, he sent up a camera with it and an audio recorder. So he just sent me those recordings. And I thought, oh, I should just set that to music. And the only way I can actually collaborate with someone who's got a brain like a planet is funnily enough, that I should be able to offer him something that is authentic with no artifice. So I'm just being completely myself. There's other people who could probably do it 10 times as well as me, but I'll just do it my way. So that's what I offer, is honesty when I collaborate with other people, and reliability. The practical part of collaborating is when we say we will do something, we always do it. You know, the world is full of people who have the great idea and don't fulfill it at all. And the 10% of people who fulfill their ideas become powerhouses of creativity. So to finish the things we start is very, very important to build up a body of collaborations.
Wow. That's very interesting. Being reliable. I hadn't thought of that. Next question. You talked about the critical thinking and that that causes a block or to your creativity. Are there other things that we need to be looking out for?
Another fantastic question. Now, can I answer this personally rather than through the literature? Because I don't know enough about the literature here. I just want to be clear. So I haven't done that sort of, you know, anal academic thing. But there's certain things that really block me. And I'm happy to name them. My own ego. You know, if I start to think about the fruits of my labor, you know, and then suddenly what I'm making is dead. It's like I'm blowing up the balloon and the balloon goes flat all over my face because I'm imagining its finished product, you know? So I think that trusting the process is the first thing whilst we're creating. The next one, I just want to be clear for myself, is that I can't do good work when I'm angry, you know? And so I know other people can, people write out their anger, but for me, I just find that when what I write is really bad angry music or really bad angry text when I'm angry, that my natural sense of space and poise is completely gone when I'm angry, and I become really, really reactive and really predictable in what I do. So that's something else. The third one, this is something that I believe very strongly in, is the greatest danger for me is self-absorption. So what I want to say to all of us, if we really want to be creative, we have to be inspired by the creativity of others regularly. If I'm a poet and I only read my own poems, it's just not going to really work, is it? But if I'm a poet and I've got 20 books of poems that are just spilling into my mind and they're fermenting in the, you know, in the tea bag of the soul, and then suddenly we pour the cup of tea and a new poem comes out, that's how creativity is. But if we're just mining our own limited experiences and all the vagaries of the mind that we've talked about, it'll probably go around in circles, and that's okay. You know, and some people get very successful in the economics of creative practice by doing the same thing. But I meet them time and time again in their creative midlife crisis, and they come looking for a new start. So, you know, eventually we all have to get to the fact that we want to do new things still.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Thank you. Next question. Any advice for musicians who have got out of practice due to PTSD and negative association between music, abuse and shame?
I'm just reading that question too, and I wanted to say to the person who's asked it, I hope you're okay. And even though it's not my part, I have a little ritual I do, because I guess you could say I'm a bit of father confessor in Canberra to a lot of musicians, and I get people coming into my office who have, they're not even the students of the ANU. Sometimes they were the students 30 years ago, actually. And they tell me about horrible things that happened to them, sometimes when they were students before they came to university, occasionally when in their university time, and often afterwards, and they're really damaged by it. So I wanted to say that this is sadly way too common, and it gives me great distress to acknowledge that we're in a world that is just deeply imperfect, and often the way we make music and teach music too often is almost bordering on abuse, that it's my way or the highway, and it's criticism, criticism, criticism. And like, say, for example, you're a kid learning the visual arts, and you do a painting when you're 10, and everyone goes, that's really beautiful. And they're going, well, that's just sort of a stick figure with a dress on it. But they go, that's really beautiful. But you're 10 years old, and you pay your prelude for your second grade piano exam, and you're told it's terrible. That's just really weird, isn't it? And we have various versions of that. There's many a teacher, particularly in classical music, who has bullied their students. Sadly, there were even people who've engaged in physical, emotional, and sexual abuse to people. And I think that's the most despicable act of betraying the act of the greatest sacred connection, which is the making of art with someone and helping them to make it. So on behalf of whatever happened to you, I just wanted to put a seed of forgiveness and healing to you, from my soul to yours. And I think that's the only way it can happen, is to process this, to acknowledge the depth of what you've experienced, but ask the divine, ask your higher self for a way through and around that, that your creativity might be a part of your healing. And I think it is possible, but it will take time.
Thank you. That was very heartfelt. What advice would you give someone who has lost self-belief and they're an artist?
Well, this is a big thing for us all too. I mean, I don't know an artist. Actually, I know a few, and they're completely deluded. So unless you're the deluded artist who just thinks you're really great, all of us have a side of us that go, look, I don't think that thing was very good, actually. You know, it's like we agonize over something, and then we go, oh. And that's the normal part. But what can happen is that suddenly becomes about us as an artist rather than the artwork. So I have a simple solution, which is we make the subject the art, the music, the writing, not our souls. So we, of course, we put our soul and our heart into it. But when we make that thing, it's its own creation and it stands on its own two feet. Our self-esteem is not dependent on that, how that goes in the world. And I learned that technique because particularly early in my career, I had quite a lot of bad reviews. And I can remember the worst review I ever got. Someone hated me so much. And funnily enough, you know, this bothered me for years, this review. It was on the Australian, which is sort of like, it's a Rupert Murdoch paper. So it's sort of like the right-wing paper, and I'm a bit of a lefty. And so I think the reviewer just sort of hated my music and everything I stand for when I was young, and was just looking to scare me off a bit. But that's what I thought anyway, because 25 years later, I'm actually really good friends with that reviewer, and they could not even remember writing the review. Isn't that a teaching? I carried around waste thoughts for decades on that review, right? And when I finally became friends with the reviewer and finally got the guts up to ask that reviewer, they said, after a while they could remember it. And they said, I just have to think of something that's critical because it's, I'm writing for the newspaper. If I just tell people I like it all the time, I'll lose my job. And I'm going, So on some level, that's what we all have to deal with, you know? There is also the thing that not everyone is destined to become famous. We also have a myth that to be a good artist or creative person is to be famous. And those things often have nothing in common with each other. So I also wanted to say that sometimes if I don't earn a lot of money through my art or my art making, this can affect my self-esteem. Now, we can't compare ourselves to the 3% of artists who make a lot of money, because I don't know the statistics for the UK, but they'll be similar to Australia. The average professional and artist in Australia makes about $30,000 a year. But for their core work, the thing they most like to do, it's between $3,000 and $8,000 a year, you know? And these are the people who are the best, you know? So the reality is most people don't make a lot of money making art, you know? We have to be motivated by the greater good and what is possible. And if we make the money from it, that is a bonus. There's nothing wrong. I just say this to everyone I meet. There is nothing wrong with having a day job. I mean, I have a day job. I run this music school. You know, I mean, it's around music all the time. But essentially, I'm just an email machine between, you know, sort of 9 and 7 p.m. every day. And only then do I start thinking in my artistic self. So I hope that helps a little bit. And I hope you can feel better in your creative life.
If you're a singer and you're frequently sick with respiratory tract infections, What can you do about it? Any advice?
The first thing I would do is just to check that there's no nodules on the vocal folds or anything like that. So I'd actually go and see a specialist and get a scan. And that is just really important to make sure there's no real damage. And some people actually can have a damaged physiology without actually having even sung that badly. It can just be how they're born with a great sensitivity in that part of the body. So it's worth checking that out. The next thing is, I think it's really important to see a number of teachers to think which teachers can help you through it. But the real job isn't with a singing teacher when things are like this. It's usually through allied health. So one thing that I like, you know, because I love Indian culture, I find a good Ayurvedic doctor can be very, very good about thinking about these things, or a Chinese medicine specialist, to think about ways that we can release. Often what happens is there's something stuck in here, whether it's a physical or an emotional sense of being stuck, that can be in here. And it can just be the notion of, if you've had the infection and it's become infected again and again, there can be a real energy sap there. So it can just be related to a bug we got, or can be related to deep emotional issues as well. So I think there needs to be a process of examining from the heart and the soul what is the cause of this. And that will involve mainstream medical practitioners, possibly allied health practitioners, and possibly the process of counseling. And then when that is done, work with someone like a dietitian to look at how you can really support, you know, yourself, because there are certain things that obviously are much better for things like phlegm in the voice, which can be sort of mitigated, you know, because phlegm can, you know, make things get reinfected. So without being at all a doctor on this sphere, I've seen a lot of singers have problems like this. And I'm sorry to say, there's rarely is a quick fix, but it is amazing that if we go through a process deliberately and slowly with patience and by observing the self, things often do change over time.
Thank you. Any advice on getting into a music practice again when you've dropped out at the height of your career and have to start again after several years?
Can I say another fantastic question? I love this question. What I would suggest for this is that we have to love practice. You know that old saying, before enlightenment, you know, chop wood, and after enlightenment, chop wood. If we get a bit famous for a while, the first thing is to realize that it's an ethereal act. You know, nothing lasts forever. You know, I can remember the first time I got, you know, a major broadcast, I was on top of the world, you know, and then 2 days later, I felt rather flat because suddenly no one was ringing me anymore. You know, it is exciting when we get, you know, things into the public sphere and people like it, and it can be addictive. So the first thing I wanted to say, that all of us, when things get out and start to make it, we can forget the fundamental teaching, which is that everything comes from the source, you know? So if I just say that again, if it doesn't really come from me, but it comes from the source, this is only my personal belief, you know, you won't find this in the scientific literature, but I believe this very strongly, then it enables me to think that this is a spiritual and life path I've done with my artistic practice rather than just my job. And that way I can think, well, what is my practice? My practice is practicing, you know, just as someone does they might do asana yoga practice, for example, and they're doing it not to be famous, they're doing it to stay well. We say on a fundamental level that our music practice, and I'm presuming it's a music practice, is for this sense of deep wellness and the love of music. Because when we practice, it's like, you know, music is our lover and our beloved, to use that sort of, you know, historical term. We love music and we are beloved by it. And it's like, for those of us who might be married, it's like we have our wonderful second marriage that is completely legal and completely morally right to music. So many musicians I know talk about music as a marriage, once they take it on as their life path, because there are ups and downs, but music is the commitment for better and for worse. So the simple thing to do is to start and to remember the words of Rumi, come again, even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times, come again. That's what we have to do.
And this might be our final question. How might I forgive myself for creative disasters within a performance?
Oh, that's a great question to finish off with. Well, can I just say to all of us, not everything goes right, but could we, this is a simple solution I do for when things go wrong. I imagine that, do you remember the Muppets, anyone? You know, I just imagine that I'm those two old men from the Muppets. I can't remember their names. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking it's the most hilarious thing of all. All I'm imagining, I'm a 5-year-old who loves slapstick. And I'm just going, oh, on another level, it's been really, really funny. You know, and so that's the first thing is to see that, you know, when I'm in the middle of it, I have this heated, strong, intense reaction. But if, for someone who might just see that on YouTube, that might go onto a share list for funniest videos, you know? And so we might actually be giving quite a lot of joy through our failure to the world. And that's sort of quite, it's quite fun, I think, to think that. But on a more serious level, when things go wrong, it's a teaching on lack of control, you know? Just the reality is things go wrong all the time. I mean, I've had just so many things go wrong in music performances for me. I honestly can't believe it. I'll finish by telling you a funny story. It's the 20th anniversary of the Sydney 2000 Olympics, and I know you had the London Olympics not that long ago. So I was lucky. I had two major commissions for the Olympics, and one of them was for a runner called Cathy Freeman, who you might remember, who won the 400 meter gold, an Aboriginal woman. And it was a big part of reconciliation in Australia. So I was commissioned to write a small didgeridoo concerto, but that was to be played at the Art Gallery of New South Wales while she ran her race for basically for the diplomats of the world who were visiting, who didn't want to be in that sort of uncouth stadium. So it was a bizarre commission, right? So I get this really great didgeridoo soloist and the orchestra's playing. He turned up, having sold the instrument in the key I'd written the entire piece for, and turned up with a didgeridoo in another key 5 minutes before the thing started. Now, that was, I mean, you could just imagine what happened to my mind. You know, despite my, you know, belief that I'm a meditator, I just went completely crazy for about 2 minutes because I just thought, this is unsalvageable. What do I do? Do I tell people? Do I let on? And then I couldn't stop laughing. I saw the ludicrousness of it all. So we came up with a solution, which was that I would, instead of conducting from the front, I conducted from behind the didgeridoo player, and I would give him a little gentle kick every time he should come in and come out. And I was just working that out as I was conducting the rest of the ensemble. No one knew. He and I have been good friends to this day, and we joke about it because it's just one of those great shared experiences. But had I not found just a bit of a gift from whatever the absolute is, I would have never have forgiven the guy, right? So that's my version of that story. It keeps on happening. We just have to get used to it and to say, on some level, we're here to put stuff up into the world that is imperfect. The myth of perfection is only a myth. And that's a myth, especially in recording, a myth based on technology where everyone's put in tune and made to sound perfect. So when we hear people live now, we don't think they sound good enough, but they sound basically how they always sounded, like humans.
What a lovely story to end on. Thank you so much. I have one question for you. If people are interested to join the one-on-one concerts that you spoke about before the talk, how would they go about doing that?
Now, I'm not sure that it's in the UK at the moment. It started in Germany from the Gewandhaus Orchestra, and it's in a few places. But I imagine, I mean, there's plenty of people from the Gewandhaus who are actually from the UK. So I think that start by just actually Googling. I think it's one colon one or one-on-one concerts. And there'll be a German site and also an Australian site. I think they're the two main sites, but it's in a number of countries. If it's not there, could I suggest that someone starts it? You know, because the woman Steffi is incredible, and she would be very happy for someone to start it in the UK if it hasn't. That's how it started in Australia. My colleague Sally Walker just decided I should start a version of this in Australia, and now we're doing it in six cities, which is just wonderful. So people are getting to experience it all the time. So if that's the end of the questions, I'm going to finish with a short dedication to wish everyone well. And so I just wanted to actually, so to everyone who has an artistic life, or is a musician, or has anything, I want to ask that your music or your creative practice can be renewed just in a small way from today, and that you can trust that you have enough available in your own experiences, in your mind, in that beautiful, untouched soul of yours to do whatever you need to do in this life. And that all of us are here and we can play our part in relieving the suffering of the world slightly. and we can leave this place a little bit better than when we came. So thanks everyone for being with me today. And thank you to the Inner Space Center for creating inner and outer space for us this evening.
And many, many thanks to you, Kim, for making the time, joining us and sharing the music. There are many, many comments coming in, appreciation for the talk and the inspiration, as well as for the music. We look forward to having you back again.